Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours. In store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551 is our text number. We have an exciting programme ahead of us. A lot of it will be made by your good selves. Because we're going to be asking you at home, have you got any artefacts and curios and collectibles that you think might be appropriate for the Little Museum of Dublin? Or indeed, you want to tell the story of it, or we're never short of ideas here, you might want to find out a story attached to it, so to speak, because we have in studio Dr. Daryl Hendley-Rooney from Crumlin in Dublin. But Daryl is historian and curator at the Little Museum of Dublin. Will you explain to our listeners who haven't seen the Little Museum what it is, Daryl?
Thanks for having us on, Joe. Yeah. So the Little Museum of Dublin, it's like the history lesson you never had in school.
Okay.
So our unique collection of artefacts has been basically come together through the generosity of the Irish people. So our collection's policy is by donation.
Okay.
And that goes from historically significant artefacts, things, for example, like the accreditation letter of the Dáil Plenipotentiaries, that negotiation party that went over to London in December 1921 to negotiate the Anglo-Irish Treaty, to more mundane things, for example, like old groceries, millennium milk bottles, things like that. So they speak to, I suppose, the experience of life.
Well, let's be clear now. We do not want any more millennium milk bottles. Do not phone in. There are a million of them. We all got one.
I think everyone.
Unless it's engraved.
Unless engraved by Mr. Premier Dairies himself.
But I'm sure people have. You've incredible stuff you're after bringing with you. 51551, joe@rt.ie. And tell us about the premises, which is in Stephen's Green. It's a great location.
It's a great location. We're delighted to be there. We've been there since 2011. Our patrons there who own that premises is the Dublin City Council.
Oh, great.
One of our main patrons, alongside the Department of Culture and also Fáilte Ireland. And we've been, since 2011, since we were registered charity, but since then, we've basically been working towards bringing universal access into that building. Okay. That building itself, Joe, that's our primary artefact.
Okay, and what's been done at the minute? Why is it closed at the minute?
It's closed at the minute. We do have a pop-up museum on Pembroke Street, it's closed. It's reopening in the summer. We've installed a lift for universal access, which is great.
To make it more accessible, yeah.
Well, it's,
but you have to, to make it accessible.
We have to.
Full stop. Yeah, rightly so. Accessible for everybody. Okay, let's start with Martin Fitzgerald. Martin, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe.
How are you keeping?
Good, not too bad. Yourself?
Good. What have you got?
For us? Stephen Roach's yellow jersey from the Tour of France win in 1987.
Wow.
So that's what I've got, basically. It's a presentation of me getting that as part of a competition. Back in 1987, when the old Evening Press kind of launched a competition to win kind of either his yellow jersey, his pink jersey from the Giro d'Italia, or else his World Champions jersey. But the first prize was one of the yellow jerseys he got as part of the 1987 win in the Tour de France.
And the footage we all remember from that, Martin, is Charles J. Hi.
Yes, correct.
The T-shirt at the time.
In Paris.
And we only discovered recently he loved Paris and he spent a lot of time in Paris, but he was there for Stefan Roach. And this is the actual jersey he wore, or he won, effectively.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now, hanging on the wall, basically.
That's
here.
Incredible.
So, kind of, where technology has progressed now in cycling jerseys, it's not the Lycra, as we see now today. It's kind of cotton with kind of the old patches kind of sewn on, and with the Credit Lyonnais kind of individual kind of
the
letters
logo,
all logo put on the jersey itself. So, yeah, that's here, kind of staring at that every day, looking in the hall. So it's signed and everything by Stephen Roach as well.
And how did you get it? You said you won it in a competition. What was the skill needed?
The Evening Press kind of launched a competition in conjunction with Goal.
The great charity.
There was a donation to be made to Goal as part of the entry of the competition.
Okay.
So I submitted it as part of a whim, and it literally kind of received. I was down on holiday, I think in Mayo at the time, and looking at the paper back then, like, I realised that I kind of won first place. I was totally amazed at it. So, yeah, back down to Dublin then, and basically getting the bus, the 15B bus, into kind of the Fleet Street office, where the old premises, I think, where the Evening Press were.
Yeah.
And then John O'Shea was there, basically, myself, aged, I think, 12 at the time, my dad as well, so literally. Stephen Roach was meant to be there at the time, but couldn't attend, so... Yeah, it's a photograph of us getting presented with the jersey there.
That's incredible, isn't it, Darrell? To have that actual... Like, I think the biggest so-called, we don't call them ticker tape rays, but the biggest, Martin, you probably remember this, Darrell, you might be too young. The biggest open top, apart from Italia 90, which was different in that sense, it was because it was a team sport, but the biggest open top ever for a single individual sports person, and it hasn't been equaled since, was Stephen Roach when he came back from winning the Tour de France. Am I right?
Absolutely. I'm too young, but I've seen the footage.
So this jersey is important.
Absolutely. I mean,
now, are you going to hold on to it, Martin?
It's just sitting here kind of looking at the hall, so I pass it by every day, so I'm quite willing to donate it. It's part of Dublin history too as well, wow. So... Yeah, that would be kind of something I would definitely offer public.
Martin, it's serendipitous because just last week I received the gift bike. Do you know about the gift bike?
No.
So the gift bike was the bicycle that Stephen Roach won the Ross on.
Okay.
It's an incredible piece of cycling history. It's called the gift bike because no money has ever changed hands in terms of its ownership.
Okay.
It's currently owned by Dr. Tom Daly, who's a great expert on the Ross. He's produced a fabulous book.
The Ross
on the subject, the Ross Talton.
The Irish, yeah.
But the gift bike has just been restored and it's been given to us on loan. And so it's going to be in the museum when we reopen in the summer. And Martin, I think it would be really incredible to accompany it perhaps with that jersey if you're willing to give it to us.
Will you cycle in with it, Martin?
Well, I'm a cyclist myself. So
On your bike. does the jersey fit you?
Well, at the time when I was 12, I wore it once or twice, but literally, no. It's in its last frame now, even on the wall.
Okay,
here,
there's loads. You can sort it out yourself, but you can lend it, you can give it or whatever, but you wanted to be seen, rightly so, which is extraordinarily, extraordinarily generous of you. That's very, very... have you anything else in the house while I'm in the house with you, Martin?
Just one of the Ireland jerseys from 2016, the rugby, I think, crowd...
Okay.
That's all signed by Johnny Sexton and all those jerseys too as well. So literally, yeah, we got a trip in to see the guys, we got a jersey signed by the whole squad there as well. So literally, yeah.
And you saw them sign the provenance of it is.
Yes, we have all pictures of it. Johnny Sexton signed it, and then Zeebo as well. The whole lot signed it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because Darrell, say what is matter, but Darrell, when you see rugby jerseys signed or whatever, how do we know they're signed by?
Well, the provenance. I mean,
yes.
Sometimes it's obvious, as you know, if there's photographs, evidence to support it. Sometimes with these things, if we can't confirm it, you can display it, but you said, oh, this is apparently signed by...
Well, there was a story in an Irish sporting organisation that... was it just in the public domain anyway, that people were signing jerseys. Okay, Martin, we'll put you in touch separately and off air with Darrell, and you
no
can...
No problem, Joe.
That's extraordinarily generous of you. Really is now, Martin. Thanks indeed, Martin Fitzgerald.
Nice,
Joe at
RT.ie.
Stay with 51551 if you want to get in touch with curios or collectibles you might have in the house. Catherine Heffernan. Catherine, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Okay, what have you got, Catherine?
I have a letter, Joe, from Sinead de Valera, President de Valera's wife, from 1968.
Okay.
I was a small child. I was 8 years of age.
Mm.
We got a present of her book, Fairy Tales of Ireland.
Right.
And we loved the stories.
Yeah.
And my mother used to read them to us. I was only kind of getting into reading. She was quicker than I was to read them. So she read them to myself and my sister. And then I got this idea at 8 that I'd love to write to Mrs. de Valera.
Very good.
So,
well done.
With my childish writing, and I don't exactly remember what I said, but I was hoping she might write more stories. I think that was the object of the exercise. But anyway, lo and behold, we sent off this letter anyway, and a couple of weeks later, one Saturday morning, we used to post on Saturdays back in those days, I got a letter addressed to me, age 8, who wouldn't be getting much post, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the letter addressed to me with the Orison Oakeron stamp on it.
Wow.
And It was from Mrs. De Valera. Okay. Do you want me to read it, Joe? Or?
Yeah, please do, yes.
Yeah, it says, it's headed paper from Doris Nolteron, yeah. The 21st of Samhain, 1968, she has written down. And she says, "My dear Catherine, your letter brought me much joy. I am indeed very glad that you like the little stories. Letters like you encourage me to write more. Yeah. You are a very fortunate little girl in having such a kind, sympathetic mother. The kind wishes I send to you are also sent to her and little Roisin." Ah, that was my sister, Rosemary. "This note takes my big thanks for your encouraging letter. Yours fondly, Sinead De Valera."
Okay, and she obviously, it's an individual letter because she refers to other people by name in the letter related
to
you. Yeah,
exactly, exactly. Yeah. And by written in fountain pen.
Oh,
and,
beautiful.
Yeah, and beautiful writing, and wrote the address, our address on the envelope and all herself. So you can imagine the excitement, Joe, back in those days to get a letter from somebody that you only saw on the television.
Yeah, and Sinead. Yeah. As they call her, Sinead Ban de Valera. She was
Sinead Ban de Valera, exactly. And she must have been, I'd say she was probably around 80 at that stage.
Yeah. Well, Sinead, for me growing up, Sinead Ban de Valera was always 80. She was always kind of mother of Ireland,
mother
a very gentle woman. And then in the photographs, I remember her with John F. Kennedy, and then I remember her, I think Charles de Gaulle, he was so tall, she was so petite and beautiful. But anyway, that's a lovely, Daryl, I've often wondered, who owns that letter? Does the estate of Sinead Ban de Valera own the letter, or does Catherine own the letter? Do you follow me?
Yeah, it's a fair question. I would say that Catherine owns it.
Yeah.
I mean, any sort of artefacts that come in like that or anything, I think the ownership is obviously with Catherine herself. But it's a gorgeous piece to have. I mean, there's, like, as you say, it's the connection with Sinead de Valera. And it's a great piece of kind of support, as you say, the mother of Ireland, that sort of figure. And actually acknowledging the woman in
the home. Well, you have only so much space.
But one area, I mean, women's history. Women have been written out of history, as you know. And it's about telling those stories. And, I mean, Sinead de Valera was very influential. I mean, their son, Eamon de Valera Jr., was the gynaecologist who delivered Sinead O'Connor. So apparently, if the story is true, maybe someone's listening online can confirm this. Apparently, Sinead O'Connor was named Sinead after Sinead Ban de Valera. And that's how influential she was. But she, you know, she's often forgotten about behind Eamon. So
you'd like to have a look at this.
I'd love to, yeah. We'd be delighted to receive. If any of your listeners, they can contact us by email at hello@littlemuseum.ie with any photographs and a couple of fuckle about the object. We'd be delighted.
And the other thing as well, Catherine, it's totally legible, isn't it?
Oh, it's completely legible, Joe. No problem at all. It has stood the test of time, actually, very well.
It's hard to believe she reared a doctor. With their handwriting.
Indeed.
What a lovely piece.
They could have taken lessons from her anyway.
And Catherine, where do you have it stored? Do you have it in the nice...
I have it in the china cabinet, Joe.
The
sitting room. Yeah.
Do you still have a china cabinet?
I
thought they went down with the button boots,
They probably did, and the letter. But if Daryl was interested, I mean, I would be very willing to loan it or anything.
Okay,
you know,
great.
Yeah.
Okay, all this is going to, Dara will go through it all at the end of the programme, but it's great, it's a lovely piece here. Go to Mila Mahagher, that's Catherine Heffernan, and Niamh Daly. Niamh.
Hello, how are you, Joe?
Good.
How's the form? How are you doing?
Good, what have you got?
Would you believe, where will I start?
Have you got it in your hand? Have you got it there now?
I didn't know. It's up on the wall, Joe. It's pride of place.
Oh,
it's on my wall. I pass them every day.
I'm excited.
And I genuflect and I bow to it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's
what
a beautiful, beautiful letter from, may he rest in peace, Charlie J. Haughey.
Ah, okay.
A great man.
And what was the occasion?
A fellow dub.
Yeah, of course.
Well, I'm a fellow dub, and we moved to the country, and I wrote to him. And we would have, you know, gone out on a lot of canvassing and everything up in our days up in Dublin, and we would have known Mr. Haughey very well.
Okay.
And I wrote to him for words of encouragement when I was due to get married in 2006.
Right.
And lo and behold, I just wrote off and I said what a great man he was and I thought he was fantastic. And I suppose I wanted something nice or good coming up to the wedding to surprise my then husband. So I wrote off anyway, and lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, he wrote back to me. And
lovely.
Will I read it out to you, Joe?
Oh, please, yeah, absolutely.
I know you have a picture there now, but it reads, "Dear Niamh, thank you for your letter and your very kind comments, which I greatly appreciate.
Okay.
Congratulations in advance on your forthcoming marriage to Sean Daly. I wish you both every happiness and success." And then he was delighted to hear that there was affiliation to Sean Lamass, and he valued that association highly. And then he said he'd have the pleasure of sending me a lovely message in time for my wedding.
And
he did, and I read it out.
Lovely. And did you meet Charlie? You must have met him.
Oh, sure. There's many a photograph in the house with my family meeting him.
Okay.
And going, it was outside a pub, would you believe? My brother had a lovely photograph, and it says the first past the post. Now, I think it was down in Kerry somewhere, that pub is. But we have loads of photographs.
So what was he like in real life?
He was, well, do you know what? And I have to say this to you, I think my father looks like him.
Okay.
And I'm sure my dad is listening here and he's throwing back his head having a good laugh.
But he was
my dad would look like him in his youth.
Yeah, but he was very, very charismatic. I was looking last week at, I don't know how it came up, a 35-minute interview on Kenny Live years ago with Pat Kenny. It was a great interview, interviewing Charlie, how he mischievous the two of them were, and Charlie was at his... He'd left politics at that stage, but he was at his wily, mischievous, witty best. Is there a museum in Charlie? Hi, Daryl.
Well, in your listener's house, it sounds like. I'd love to go out and see it. Yeah, I mean, Haughey, we actually have a really quirky object in the museum collection related to Charles J. Haughey, and it's one of the Abbeville honeypots. Do you know about this? Have you heard about this?
No, tell us.
He had his own apiary out there. He produced his own honey
on
the estate. And if you're lucky enough, while you're out there visiting, you got one of these beautiful pots of Abbeville honey embossed into the honey pot. So we do actually have Charlie's honey pot in the museum collection.
But these letters in themselves, Catherine, Niamh, I don't mean to put it this way to you, but these letters in themselves, have they any intrinsic value? If Niamh, God forbid Niamh, if Niamh wanted to sell them,
Wouldn't think of selling them, Joe.
I know you wouldn't, Niamh. That's why I asked you to turn off your radio for a second. Yeah. If Niamh tried to sell them, would they have any?
I mean, when it comes to this
thing, the world we live in.
It depends on who it's related to, I suppose, and the significance of the message, who's actually corresponding. But I think what it does highlight is the beauty of, and the dying art, I suppose, of letter writing, Joe.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact, Niamh, that you wrote, and the earlier listener, Catherine, wrote to Sinead de Valera, I mean, who writes letters to the good and the great now? You know, if you send an email, you know, it's not the same, you know, having it there. So, I mean, you know, they're the sort of things that you should cherish. And
just to mark that as well, I think my wedding was a week or two before poor Joe or poor Charlie passed away.
Oh, wow.
In 2006.
Yeah.
So that would have been one of his last letters that he wrote.
Well,
and I am forever grateful. He was a great man, Mr. Charlie.
So hang on about the date. You're saying, when you got married, and I know it was 2008, so Charles J. Haughey had left politics, so to speak, and he was in Abbeville, and people used to, they were forever looking for interviews and to contribute to books. Vincent Brown is writing a book. A nation holds its breath for Vincent's book. I hope it's coming out soon. And Gary
I'm not near my computer, but didn't he pass away maybe in 2006?
Yeah. And
I think it was even...
Taoiseach and three... 13th of June 2006. What's the date on your letter?
The date on my letter? Well, I read it out. I got married on the 8th of... I got married the 8th of June 2006.
Wow. There you are now. That's a connection. Okay, Niamh, hold on to that. Daryl will speak to you. Kevin O'Sullivan. Kevin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
A money box and a cigarette tin. Will you explain to our listeners what a cigarette tin is, Kevin?
Okay, well, I have it here in my hand, Joe. It's a player's navy cut cigarette box, okay, or tin. And it's made from metal, and you would take your cigarettes and you would put them in that, put them in your pocket. They wouldn't get crushed, essentially, I suppose, when you shoved them into your pocket. So that's just a thing that's been handed down here in the family. And the money box, more importantly, I think, I believe it was my dad's money box, either his or his mother. Now, my dad died in 2018. He would have been in his late 80s.
And what do you mean? What's a money box? Is it a piggy bank?
It's like a piggy bank, but it's a shiny metal box with a little handle on it. And it has a brass plate on the front of it, Bank of Ireland, and a map of the island of Ireland on the front of it. And I tried to date it, Joe, but I couldn't manage to date it. But
Daryl, did you ever see one of these before? The money box.
The money box. I've seen similar ones, not with that relief, I suppose, on it, with the island and the Bank of Ireland on it. But you do see
beautiful piece of brass.
You find these really creative little saving money boxes, even older ones, the Leinster Munster Bank, for example. And they're really beautiful. And they're actually constructed like little books. They look like little books and with a little lock. I presume there's a little lock on that, is there?
There is. In fact, one of my friends I was mentioning about this little heirloom that's going to find its way to you guys, and she had one of those books, and you put your money in it, and you could put the book into the bookshelf, and
you have the keys. Have you opened it? Is that in it?
There's a fortune in it, Joe. I wish.
And by the way, was the aperture in the money box, was it for coins or for coins, I presume?
Just coins, coins. I found a few old pennies and I put them in a few old pennies. But I tell you what I did find interesting about the whole thing. Now, I wouldn't know a whole lot exactly about how I came across it, but my dad was an only child and his parents, my grandparents, ran a shop, shoe shop, up in Stony Batter.
Still there, isn't it?
Well, no, not this one. This is O'Sullivan's Fine Footwear, and it closed in the 80s. But me and my siblings were talking about the box and about just all the history of driving the cattle down the street to the cattle market and everything, and the docks. And it just, the whole museum thing sort of jogs memories that it's more than the item itself. It's what stems from it that I really liked about these things.
And people don't realise this, Daryl, do they? And you do, obviously, Kevin, at the top of Stony Batter, where Dernard's estate is now, that used to be the big cattle market.
Cowtown,
and the cattle Cowtown, would come in and then they'd be bought and sold and then they would be transported. They'd make their own way.
They'd make their own way down the
North Circular Road in cavalcades or stampedes.
Stampedes,
times,
yeah.
Down to the North Wall, down the cattle board. I never forget it either.
Yeah, I mean, I was only young for that. I was born in 61, and I remember them driving down. The drovers would be there with their sticks, and they'd be banging them off the signs. There'd be some signs at certain shops that would make a metal sign, and they'd bang it off that to sort of hoosh the cattle. And this is almost unbelievable nowadays to think about this.
So you are prepared to give this to the museum?
Absolutely. Delighted to get more exposure. So.
Oh, you're very
grateful.
Wow. And do you know what? It's actually interesting. A lot of this stuff, when you think, you mentioned this, Joe, earlier on, the kind of intrinsic worth. Mm. But there's so much meaning and so much richness that actually comes out of even looking at the design, from a marketing perspective.
Design,
the actual Bank of Ireland, the fact is the whole island of Ireland that's depicted on it.
Then the piggy banks became, one of them was Harry the Hippo, wasn't it?
Harry the
Plastic things.
Plastic.
And remember, Kevin, just so listeners at home might get a taste of what you lived through when the cattle went from Dunard, from the corner there, Cowtown, down the North Circular Road to the North Wall. It was like living in Pamplona, wasn't it, on the day of the running of the bulls?
Oh, it was incredible because, like,
it was very dangerous. Very exciting.
Yeah, it was a bit of both because we grew up in Whitehall and like we were city slickers, we weren't really in the countryside at all. And to see this going on, it was like that for us. And the pigs as well would be brought to the abattoir there at times. It's like the wild.
You know what the abattoir now is, Kevin? Have a guess. It's an apartment block.
The abattoir,
which is just across the road from the cattle market. Anyway, well done. That's Kevin O'Sullivan. Betty Mitchell, a regular. Betty, what have you got? She's a millennium milk bottle. Betty.
Oh, Lord.
Tell us.
Yes, I've got the milk bottle.
Is the milk still in it?
No, the milk bottle, I know. Joe, but I have got the most beautiful, the Millennium poster.
Ah.
And it has the history of Ireland. You've got the Vikings, you've got the Norsemen, you've got the Book of Kells, you've got Jonathan Swift, you've got, what's his name, Stephen Roach, Brendan Beale.
Oh, famous Dubliners, yeah, yeah.
There's just so many in
it. I didn't know they gave out a poster with the Millennium milk bottle.
I've got it up on my landing, up at the top of the stairs.
Oh, done.
It's absolutely beautiful. But I've also got, the gentleman might be interested,
Darryl, yeah.
Copy of Stony Batter, Dublin's Inner Urban Village.
Ah. A book.
The book.
It's by Kevin C. Kern.
Oh, yeah, the great Kevin. Kern, yeah, Kevin, yeah. Yeah. Kevin has done so much in terms of
Stony Batter.
Archive in Dublin and stories. And okay, and Betty, are you saying, are you describing this or you want to give it to the museum?
Well, I'll give him the milk bottle and I'll give him the book, but not the poster. He okay. can have it when I'm dead and gone.
You're very kind, Betty, and we are actually opening the little library of Dublin when we reopen the museum in the summer.
Yeah.
So that'll be a great addition to our library collection, Betty. And that poster is incredible. I'm just looking at it here. Really interesting thing for your listeners. There's no women in that image at all, is there?
Wow.
They're all men.
Wow, to get away with that.
You know, Swift, you know, Brendan so Beale, unfair. Roach,
well,
Geldof,
yeah.
you know.
Well, even surely we could have got Evie Hone in, one of our great artists, one of our great Countess Markovich. There was enough people, Mary Swansea, Mary Swansea and Evie Hone were Dubliners, Countess Markovich, obviously. Well,
and just
Betty, I know you're very eloquent. Would you use your powers to describe the Millennium Milk Bottle for people who might not be familiar with it?
As I remember, I always had the cream off the top of the milk.
Yes.
Come in, be outside the door.
So it's a milk bottle.
It's a milk bottle,
yes.
clear white glass.
Yes.
1998, Dublin, and it's got the symbol, you know, the blue and red. And.
But it has the good thing, the unusual thing about it is that it has three colours on it, where milk bottles in those days might have had a label printed on it, but and then obviously the foil top had the name of the company, but it has three colours. Now, I think there's about 10 million of them, Betty.
I think there is a lot of.
Okay.
I wouldn't let it go, but it's a premier milk bottle.
Okay.
It's the original one.
Yeah,
it's
Premier Dairies. Yeah, and Premier Dairies, which is on the Finglas Road. And years ago. You know what that is now, Betty? Apartments. Okay, let me take Betty, God bless you. Talk to you soon. Have a good St. Patrick's weekend over there in Birmingham. That's the great Betty Mitchell. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Dr. Darryl Hendley Rooney is in studio. He's a historian and curator of the Little Museum of Dublin, soon to reopen in a completely revamped premises, which is there at the Grafton Street side of Stephen's Green. And when they started originally, I think it was the Marion Finucane show you put out the appeal on back in the day. And there's a revamp going on. And thankfully, loads of people have loads of interesting things, including Alfie Deehan. Where are you based, Alfie?
Oh, how are you, Joe? I'm based in the fields of Greenfields of Acton Rye. How are you getting on?
Good man, and how are you?
Not too bad.
What have you got there, Alfie?
Well, where do you want me to start? I start with the bottles first, the chemist bottles, right?
Yes, okay, yeah.
I think I've over 40 of those. They were known as apothecary jars, and they used to display small amounts of substances. And the brown ones were called Boston or Winchester, but they were all the go in 40, 50, 60 years ago. Those bottles now would probably be over 100 years old.
Okay.
Because I was in that business, and I worked around your area through Ballyfermot, and now and again, a chemist would say, I'll give you one of those, Alfie, because he knew I liked them. So over the period of time, my 15 to 20 years working in Dublin and the West, of course. I gathered them up, so that's why I've accumulated them. But there's a history to every one of them, and indeed the poor folks that gave them to me are all dead and gone now, I'd say, because those particular ones, those jars they're well over 100 years old now, you know.
And it sounds like you have the makings of a museum yourself there, Alfie.
Well, I gathered bits and pieces, you know, down through the years, and I hate throwing anything out. But that's the story on the, as I said, the Pantagary jars. You got photographs. You see how they're shaped.
Oh, they're beautiful.
You
see, yeah.
You actually, you know, if you go into some of the modern chemists, they have them displayed in lovely display cabinets as well, inside the counter.
Well, Alfie, there's a new pub just after opening at the junction of Merrion Row and Merrion Street. They're the closest pub to the government buildings, and that's in the style of a chemist. Isn't that right, Darren?
Really?
I've seen it online.
A new style to it, yeah. Obviously, yeah. One of the best known is the Sweeney's down there.
Kennedy's down there.
Joyce and Tyne.
But they've loads. They have all these old bottles. You could have made a fortune, Alfie, if you sold them.
I don't know. It's more to life than money.
So what? Where do you store all this memorabilia?
Well, I have a small little bar at home. I have a rake of them in the bar, and then I had some of them out of my shed in the back, nicely tucked away, you know, into the window. So that's where I keep those. And I've had those. I left Dublin in 1986, and it was transferred to the West, and I had them all at that stage. So, in fact, I got one of them, I think, there's a lovely, I can't just think of his name, he was in Claddagh Green. You'd have known that chemist there years ago. He was a chemist.
Boylan's, that's where we were, the Boylan's chemist.
Boylan's. And there was Kylie's there as well, and there was another man on La Touche Road, Lynch. Well, I know what he Lynch. I called in all those guys, but I got some of them, one or two from those people as well, you know. So just built it up over the.
And what do you intend doing with them, Alfie?
Well, I keep the best wine for the last, because is it Dr. Dara Henry you're speaking to?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah.
Hello, doctor. How are you? Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, well, I'm the type of doctor now. Don't forget, Alfie, I could only write you a prescription for maybe a tub of Sudocream.
I was going to ask you, would you cure my cold, but you can't cure it.
Well, I tell you, I'm just looking here at the bottles. They're brilliant. You'd want to be careful now. A bottle of creosotum there, poison. Just looking at that. You don't have that in your bar counter, I hope, at home.
No. Because I segregate them. I put them out, but the ones up there. But I left the labels on them to identify with the past, you know.
Yeah, well, the tinctures, I mean, when you think of all that, you think of even some other great, you know, chemist shops, place like Mushat's places, you know, Joe. So, I mean, it was so integral. I remember going as a kid to my local, which would have been, I suppose, down near Mount Argus, Tom's Chemist, and you went down to Tom's to get your cough bottles.
Well,
you know Tom's.
So you went down to get your cough bottle,
you know, that they had down there and that sort of thing. But
they would make it up themselves. They were genius.
There was a lot of chemists who did that. By the way, Alfie, what did you do? What were you, a salesman or?
Oh, I was sales. I was sales all my life. Yeah.
And what were you selling?
I started off with a company called O'Vell Dundalk, and it was OTC, all OTC, over-the-counter products.
Okay.
And it was coronation cornuts and baby creams and that type of thing, and different things, and veterinary. And then I moved on to Teva Pharmaceuticals. They were a generic company based in Waterford, trying to flag the generics down here in the West when all the patent products were selling well. And then I retired, and I'm living on the sunshine and acting right at the moment. But I have gramophones there. You might have seen the pictures of those.
Oh, damn, yeah. Loads of them. Vinyl is back.
Now, that gramophone there, one particular gramophone came into Ireland in 1910 from America, from Philadelphia in America. My aunt brought it in, and I have that now. And it's
You have a great collection, Alfie. Well done. That's Alfie Deegan and Atten Roy. Now, Darrell, I should, you brought in a load of shows, that incredible mounted piece there.
It's related to
the late Ben Dunn.
Yeah, so when we opened in 2011, we were very lucky that we got some great early donations, and one of them that came in was this. I suppose it's a great memento mori, really.
What it is
for your listeners, it is the bullets that Ben Dunn were given by his kidnappers when he was released in 1981. And, you know, that whole experience that really affected Ben, as it would, understandably. But he created this as effectively a memento mori. And the piece of stone there that it's mounted on, sort of as a plinth, that is from the graveyard that he was released in by his kidnappers.
Yeah,
and then he had these little plaques mounted on it. for marking the period from when he was kidnapped and then released. But you know, it's these sort of artifacts, this memorabilia that speak to such personal experiences in the lives of not only Dubliners but Irish people, and we're delighted to tell those stories in the collection, Joe. But that is a really
and how did you manage to get that? Did Ben bought
us? So Ben, came in. You know, it's through. I mean, as you mentioned earlier on, Marion Finucane in 2011, we went out public call for artifacts to basically put together a collection, and it's through the generosity of the Irish people that we have that collection. So, for example, one of the early listeners was Phelim Drew, and I have in studio here a great passport that belonged to the great Ronnie Drew, perhaps one of the great, in many ways, the quintessential Dubliner. And a lot of people, a lot of listeners will be listening to him with the weekend that's in it, obviously, the Dubliners on Patrick's weekend. But the unusual thing about this passport, and it was a beloved piece of memorabilia in the family, is it goes back to darker days when women were at the behest of the men in their lives. And here, this actually shows that women basically had to have a passport with their husbands. So the photographs are both on it. So they're of a specific period. But the interesting thing is where the slot is for the wife's photograph, that little space, it's actually a picture of a bearded Ronnie Drew. And what had happened was, because sometimes he was clean shaven, and so on the left-hand side where it says, you know, photograph of the bearer, which was Ronnie, and the other side where it says photo of wife, he put a photograph of himself with a beard. So the bearded lady.
But explain that to me, darling. You're saying if a married woman wanted to get a passport.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that sort of even, you know, in life, in Irish society, I mean, the interesting thing is we're working on a book on Nearies, for example. So many pubs in this country, for example, around this period, around the 50s, wouldn't serve a woman a
point. And the passport, if a wife wanted to get a passport, she'd have to get her husband's photograph on it as well.
They were both on it. So you had the bearer and the wife's photograph on it as well, and her signature on it. It's incredible. I mean, when you think about it now.
You have a great photograph there, the great Jim Larkin and Alfie Bourne.
Yeah,
the great. Two great Dublin, while Jim was a national character. In fairness, Alfie was an international character betimes. Very different politics now.
Very different politics. But this here is a great photograph given to Lord Mayor Alfie Byrne by Jim Larkin, and it's signed by him. And they're outside the Mansion House. And what I suppose two big messages from it is, the first is, my God, Jim Larkin was a big man. And really, you know, that statue on O'Connell Street doesn't do him justice. When you look here, I mean, even the men who are standing behind him, who are at the same height as him, they're actually standing on a step at the Mansion House. You know, he was a big man, an imposing man. But the other thing is, it's interesting, you know, we think about politics and we think about people that, you know, seemingly diametrically opposed politics. Yeah. I mean, here's two men standing beside each other who are at loggerheads on various issues. But this has been presented, this Evening Mail photograph, to Alfie from Jim Larkin. And that was given to us very recently by Alfie's grandchildren. So we were delighted.
Well, I started a campaign, so far unsuccessful, about 10 years ago to try and find, I'm convinced it's in some American university archive, a record of the voice of Jim Larkin.
Yeah, because he was Liverpudlian. So
and he lived to, 47? So radio, Irish radio was around from 26. UK radio and American radio, and he gave the oration at a number of very, very large Joe Hill and at those funerals. So there must be some recording, but we've never found. There is no recording of the voice of Jim Larkin. Joe Bourne, you've just come back in out of the shed. What did you find?
How are you, Joe?
Are you okay?
I'm not a bother,
good man.
I was listening to the lady talking about the milk bottle there, and my good lady wife said to me, I'm sure we've got some bottles down in the shed and there's something printed on them.
Okay.
So anyway, went down, gave it a wash, gave the bottle a wash, and it's actually a milk bottle, Premier Dairy's milk bottle, and it's Italian 90. And it has the Irish
flag. 35 years ago this week, isn't it? This year, definitely. No, it would go more into the summer. But 35 years ago.
Yeah. It says on the front of the bottle, Italian 90. It's got the tricolour. We took the world, and then it gives Calgary, Palermo, Genoa and Rome. And then on the back of it, the Irish heroes, Ireland's World Cup squad, 1990. And all the names of the players and the Jackie Charlton there, the manager, Morris Setters, Mick Byrne, Charlie O'Leary and Fran Fields.
And remember, Charlie, as of a few weeks ago, Charlie is still alive.
Yep.
And he's I think he's 104. We spoke to him when he was 100, living down in the East Wall.
Fair play to him.
And I presume, because I haven't heard otherwise, I presume he's in good fettle. Good fettle.
Yeah. Well, great we stuff. Hope he is.
Okay.
We hope he is.
I didn't know there was a World Cup Italia 1990 milk bottle.
Yeah, okay. Well, I've got four of them.
Oh, well, and the back of the bottle you have more the squad, I presume, photographs.
The squad, squad's names are on it, yeah.
Well, hold on, Darrell's listing all this down. I won't give you his immediate response, but he is positive to that. That's Joe Bourne and Raheny. Kevin Gibbons, Kevin. You went to the Little Museum of Dublin.
Hello, Joe. Hello, yeah. Darrell. How are you?
Hi, how are you doing, Kevin?
Fine. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
My wife and my toddler son and I visited the museum my son's 12 now, so it would have been in 2013, maybe in the summertime. And there was a group of maybe 12 or 15 of us there, about half and half Irish and foreign tourists. And I don't know how who was showing us around. I don't know whether it was you, Dara, or someone else.
I'm only there about 2 years, so...
Right, okay. But the guy turned us around, brought the subject around to Ulysses by James Joyce.
Ah.
And he said, has anyone here read Ulysses? And I put my hand up. Maybe one other did, I'm not sure. But the guide said, okay, tell us all about it.
Brilliant.
Thankfully, I had read it about 10 years before that.
Well, so, I'll tell you, a fourth edition of James Joyce's Ulysses, 1922, obviously. A forced edition is on the web today for €36,000. €36,000. Would you believe that? That's a forced edition. Now you can buy, as you know, today, because instead of out of copyright as such, you can buy... Has anyone, I wonder...
We have the first English edition. It was actually the amazing thing. If you're listening, Kevin, I don't know whether it was mentioned on your tour. God, over 10 years ago. It's amazing to think. So because of the strict censorship laws here in this country, the incredible thing is we were one of the first countries in the world to hire a dedicated censor, which is incredible, who is Montgomery. But because of the strict censorship laws here, Joyce couldn't obviously publish such a modernist, progressive work. So it was actually first published in French and then published in English. Okay. And when it was published in English, it was actually published in Dijon in France. And we have that on display in the Little Museum. And what we've done is, now look, I know you're in, you know, you're in the 1%, the top 1% of people who've read, not in terms of riches, but maybe literary riches. You've actually read Ulysses. So what I've done is I have the book open in the museum on the very last page. So no matter who comes into the museum, they can say that they've finished Ulysses in the Little Museum at Dublin. Yeah. But I'm delighted you had such a great experience, Kevin.
Well done, Kevin. Yeah. And your toddler son is now, 15, 16?
12 now.
Good
so
lad.
We'd love to see you in
the summer when we're open.
Thanks, Kev. The 1947 Bravery Act. What have you got from that? Tell us about that. Darrell.
Yeah, so the 1947 Bravery Act, it was basically to bring in a kind of a state recognition for civilian acts of bravery. And the first ever award was given to a docker, a guy called William Dean, William the Hero Deans. And he lived on Foley Street, north side of the River Liffey. And down in John Rogerson's Quay in 1947, basically, coal ship had come in from America, the Amasa Delano, was pulled in and there was a gas leak in one of the hatches. And thankfully, the people who went down and were affected survived. But it was sort of, Joe, a bit like a comedy film. What happened was a sailor went down, was overcome with fumes, passed out.
Right.
Wondered what happened to him. The bosun went down. He was overcome with fumes, passed out. Then the captain went down. He was overcome with fumes and passes out.
Okay.
Two more sailors went down to try and rescue the men, and they couldn't. They were also almost overcome. And this guy, Bill Deans, he had the wherewithal to wrap a handkerchief around his face, and he descended down 12 metres into the hatch. And each one of those men, he went down, wrapped a rope around them, and they were pulled up. And it was such an incredible act of bravery that he was the first person ever awarded under that 1947 Bravery Act. And the medal, his descendants, his grandson, Mark, and his family have very kindly given it to the museum. But the really interesting thing, Joe, and this is a great Dublin story, it was actually stolen in 1958, and it was only recovered 58 years later by his son.
Wow.
So there you go, in a London, after it was purchased in a London auctioneer's.
Isn't that incredible?
So it's just an incredible story, so we're delighted to celebrate it in the
great
museum.
Great that you have it. And reminder, the Dublin Docks was a dangerous place to work. I know I've seen a play recently, Dockers by Gary Brown.
Brilliant, yeah.
It's actually going to the ambassador in Dublin on the 8th of April. And Gary's father was killed.
He was killed on Dublin Docks in an accident
down there. And a lot of his story is based around that. Miriam Edge. Miriam, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you?
What have you got for us, Miriam?
I have photographs that my grandfather took of Michael Collins' funeral.
Wow. And originally, your father took the snaps, took the photographs.
No, my great father. My grandfather. My grandfather.
That's fine, yeah.
He took them. Yeah, he took them. And they're in Westmoreland Street.
Wow.
Yeah.
And have you ever seen them, that exact location, in a book or a newspaper or reference anywhere in a TV programme?
No.
So,
no,
it's very,
no,
so they're very,
yeah.
So they're very unique.
They are, yeah.
Okay, and
the ones that he took and had them developed himself.
And it would have been very unusual to have a camera.
Yeah.
In 1922.
Miriam, they're amazing.
He had a little box camera. He took loads of photographs.
Good,
now I don't know where they are. But my mother gave me those photographs. So I have them, but there's nothing I can do with them. So I want to give them to the museum.
Oh, you're so
kind. If they want them.
Well, do you know
what?
We're at the behest of what we have. And actually, this is a great coincidence. One area we don't have a lot of material in is relating to Michael Collins. And we were actually down at the National Ploughing Championships last year, Joe. And this is incredible. A little boy, about 8-9 years old, came up to... we had this temporary little pop-up exhibition.
Yeah.
And... he says, "Where's Mick?" I said, "What do you mean, where's Mick?" He says, "Where's Mick?"
Mm-hmm.
He says, "You have a painting of Eamon de Valera. Why don't you have Michael Collins?"
And what age was the child?
Oh, no more than 9 years old. It was absolutely incredible. So we are at the behest of what
Thank
we
God
have.
Civil War politics is long gone.
Long gone, exactly. So I said they would be a beautiful addition to the collection, Miriam, because as I said, we don't have a huge amount of material related to Michael Collins.
Miriam, I only have a photocopy, but can you identify the shops there? In Westmoreland.
I can't really. I'd need a magnifying glass.
Yeah, and we'll sort them out. But it clearly is a wide street.
Yeah.
And there's people. Isn't there people on the balcony there? Do you see the people up on the balcony?
Yeah.
They're fantastic. Yeah. And you're prepared. Yeah. That's great.
Well, sure. What else could I do with them?
Yeah.
I think they're kind of delicate because they're brown.
Yeah,
You couldn't put them out. They're likely to destroy them.
Well, the lads would know how to.
To preserve them.
The sepia is the word, isn't it? That was always used to describe those kind of brownie. Miriam, well done, and well done to your grandfather for being so ahead of his time.
Lovely.
Ahead of his time, Derek Oman. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
What have you got?
Well, my question is: would he take stuff on the license?
What does that mean?
In the museum.
Tell me that.
What does that mean?
We had a load of... My grandfather, his fame to fame was he was the bugler outside Liberty Hall in 1916.
Ah, that's where the name...
When they marched up to O'Connell Bridge and Pierce took over the GPO and his battalion went up and took over the City Hall. And the plaque outside has bugler William Oman. The bugle is actually up in Collins's barracks on display.
Great museum.
My aunts and my wife's aunts were all involved in coming them on.
Amazing.
And they were in Kilmainham jail in 1916 when the pages were executed.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a diary signed by various women who were, say, the Cork Brigade and the Kerry Brigade, who were interned in Kilmainham Jail.
Amazing.
And they have little slogans, you know, Sarah Gabra and things like that, and the name underneath it on the different battalions. We have Easter cards from Countess Markovich and Eamon de Valera.
Okay.
We have unpublished 1916 copies and some from 1922. We have a Cumannamon flag that was carried in 1916 and it still has the bloodstains on it.
And who's bloodstains?
We have other pieces
you know?
Of memorabilia like that. But well, we tried to give them into Kilmainham and we tried to give them to the National Museum.
Okay, tell us.
They could take them, but they've nowhere to display them.
Yeah.
And see, I'll be honest with you, when it comes to these things, we have a curatorial committee that meets and, you know, we discuss any donations. And there is an opportunity. Occasionally, we do, on very rare occasions, take in objects on loan. Generally, it's by donation. But do you know what? It's not out of beyond the realm of possibility. I'd suggest dropping us a line and we'd love to continue the conversation.
Okay, well, now, Pat, given that people are saying it when they ring us, that we can pass on your details to Daryl. Is that okay, Derek? You know, Derek,
that's perfect, yeah.
Brilliant, thanks, God, Eric.
Derek, you'd nearly set up a museum yourself. Again,
I would just be afraid that, like, we have them in a kind of a little safe.
I know.
I'd be afraid that they get damaged, like, it's stuff that you could never replace.
Absolutely.
Like, my grandfather also blew the bugle at O'Donovan Ross's funeral, one of the biggest funerals in Dublin.
Okay.
At that time, it was only 15, 16 years. You were saying about Manor Street.
Yeah.
I was originally born in the little cottages up beside the barracks there in Arbor Hill. I used to go up, my grandfather used to bring me up to see the army horses. And when I got a little bit older, I used to get 2 shillings to bring the cattle down to the boats.
Derek, you'll have me in tears here. I remember Dublin City. Derek, God bless you and the great home. The great home and family. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Memorabilia Kay is in Cork. What have you got for us, Kay?
Hi, Joe. I have a diary.
Okay.
That starts in 1883.
Wow. Magic. Regardless of
it was written, but you'd know it was written by a quill.
Oh, yeah, quill. Beautiful. Handwriting and slow and precise. And
beautiful,
style,
absolutely
style.
Beautiful.
And the diary of whom?
It's of a William Welsh.
Yeah.
A lot of the pages now he has written to his sister Blanche.
Okay.
But in some pages then he talks about Christmas time and the weather and a soldier coming to his house and they welcomed him in. This page now I've opened here, it's December 4th, 1883. Today was my birthday. I am 14, I think.
Okay.
I am frightfully old.
Yeah. Frightfully old.
I did
old
not
and
get
14.
Fancy presents. Mama gave me 2 pence.
Yeah. 2 pence was a few bob in those days, now I know.
It was in those days. It must have been a wealthy family.
And does the diary cover a year, a few years, a few months?
A few years. It goes, I think it finishes in 1888.
Okay, Now remember, you've a beautiful museum in Cork City called in Fitzgerald Park. The Cork City Museum. Have you been into that one, Kay? Beautiful, and it's free in and great staff, very welcoming. That's more obviously like Dublin's about Dublin, but the Cork one is about Cork. But it's it's lovely. But do you do diaries, as they say, Daryl? Not really,
really, it depends. I mean, something like that, I think that necessitates, it'd be lovely to transcribe that, that's what the key is, when I'm thinking about that, I'm going, right, how do you actually let the public, because you obviously can't handle it.
Yeah.
But, you know, that is something I would encourage
you.
Is
there a transition to your student in your family? That would be a brilliant project, wouldn't it?
It would be a brilliant project. Unfortunately, there isn't. They're all grown up.
Okay, well,
no, I did email 2 or 3 historians.
Yeah, okay.
But none of them got back to me,
so. Yeah, okay. Darryl will get back to you, but as you say, but I really think, and Darryl won't mind me saying this, I really think you should pop along to Fitzgerald Park.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful building, and it's of Cork. And but I think Daryl's idea of try to get somebody, go give it, say to your local second level school, you will give access to the diary if a few of the lads or lassies want to get together as a project. As a project.
Oh yes, I didn't think of that.
Because every sentence is historic, has a meaning. Like you said, what did he say? I'm frightfully old, and I got 2p. Look at what that tells us in those 7 words. You know what I mean? So do approach your local school, maybe the local history. What part of the country? I know you're in Cork. What part of Cork are you in, Kay?
We're in Middleton.
Okay. And, well, then it's brilliant second-level schools. Also, you have, I don't know whether, did universities take that type of stuff, do they?
Yeah, they can do, depending on the significance of it, I suppose. But, you know, you never know. There might
get
be
it transcribed for us. Yeah. Ask your local history teacher or TY year, would two or three of them be interested in doing it as a project? And then they could try and get photographs of the area that the William Walsh was in at the time. And it's a great idea. But the main thing is, Kay, you have guarded it safely. You've guarded it safely. Well
and
done.
You might suggest there's also the Cork Historical and Archaeological Society down there. And they have a great journalist been around for, God, I think over a century. So, you know, you might reach out to the Cork Historical Society and there might have a local historian who would be interested on maybe writing an article on it. Wouldn't that be great? So, contact them.
And keep it, you've been doing it, but keep it safely, Kay. Well done, well done. Liam Griffin, Liam. Back to Charlie. What have you got, Liam?
I have the mass book from Phil Linnett's funeral.
Ah.
On the 11th of January. He died on the 4th of January, but his funeral was the 11th.
Okay.
But so when we came up from Tralee, 5 of us, inside that black Mazda 323, and we slept in the car that night outside the church.
Well, I tell you, I'm a big fan of the great Phil Linnett, obviously being a Crumliner myself. But we have a music room in the little museum, which we're expanding the remit of. It's looked at U2 in the past, but we're now bringing in stories from the Dubliners and Thin Lizzy. So that's a really great one.
And it's, that funeral is very evocative for me personally, because I was only late teenager at the time, but myself my youngest brother Aidan, who would have been 10 years, it was 10
okay,
years
yeah.
We went out to Phil Linnett's funeral in Hoth, and then we followed cortege around to the cemetery there, but Aidan unfortunately was killed.
Father Brian was doing the mass the same day.
Father Brian. But what is Charlie Haughey connection to that?
Explain this. So when we were at the church anyway.
Okay.
We were first into the church in the morning when the priest opened the door and we took a few photos around the coffin.
Okay.
So we left anyway and we went back into town to get a bite to eat. And when we were coming back out to Hoth, we took the long turn because Hoth is all one way. So we were around the long way to go back to the church again.
Okay.
And when we were going into the church, Charlie Haughey was right in front of us going in.
Okay.
And we made the 6-1 news, which with Charlie, by the way. But anyway, Charlie was sitting right in front of us in the church. And when the mass was over, he put the mass book down on the seat, and he left. And I put my hand on it, and I picked it up, and I still have it today.
Well done.
But we went back out to Hoth, and we went into the hotel where the do was. No, we were downstairs. They were all up above. And Brian Downey happened to come down into the bar.
The guitarist, brilliant. The drummer.
The drummer.
Legendary, Brian,
And he started talking to us. And he said, oh, where did you come from, lads? Tralee. Oh, he came along with, come with me. And he brought us up into the middle of the whole lot.
That's fantastic.
At the back of the mass book, I got Brian to sign it. We met Bono in the lobby. He signed it. And the late John Sykes, he only passed away there a couple of weeks ago. He was another guitarist with Thin Lizzy. And he signed it. And I still have that. And we go up to the grave the 4th of January every year for the last 20 years.
Ah, oh, well done.
So, matter of fact, your own body is not too far away from
me. Yeah, I know that.
Gearborn, last year we went over to Charlie Haughey's grave. He's over in the old part of the graveyard, you know.
Yeah.
But he left us away too early, you know.
Yeah, you know who would have been very proud of you picking up the the man, the Charlie Hattie, Philip himself would have been.
Oh,
it's very cheeky, Charlie. Cheeky. Well done, Liam. Are you holding on to them, or are you?
No, I couldn't part with it.
Okay,
of course, I understand that. You know, I'm a Tunisian fan all my life.
Of course.
What's your favourite song? It'd
have to be a Wild One.
Wild One, okay.
Wild One, you know. What album was that?
Were you a bit of a wild one yourself, Liam, back in the day?
Well, hold on to it
safely. It's brilliant.
And of course, the mother was a lady as well. So she was.
God bless you, Liam. And then remember the brilliant Bruce Shields song.
And the
boats in Hoth, our old pal, are lying safe in Hoth, and Phil, old pal, so are you.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715
815. Okay, we're going to rattle through them. Darrell's going to take a list. He won't necessarily say yay or nay. Helena Cofolo in Galway, what have you got, Helena?
How you doing, Joe?
Good.
I have a market stick that my father gave me. His name was James O'Reilly. He was from Prussia Street in Dublin, and he was a cattle dealer.
And what's a market stick?
It's about 6 inches long, and it's wood, and there's lead on the end of it. I can't remember, Joe. I'm 72, so I can't remember that. But they used to use it on the cattle for marking them.
Oh, you'd mark it. You actually mark it. Okay.
Yeah, for marking the cattle. And I also have a beautiful cross that was given to him as a luck penny.
Okay.
It's about 5-6 inches high in a leather case.
Okay, and a marking stick. Okay, thanks, James. Thanks, Alina. In Galway, James in Sligo. James, what have you got?
Joe, good afternoon. I have an unused ration book from 1951, belonged to my mother. She never actually... never actually used any of the coupons in the book.
Wow.
And her name and address is on it.
From 1951?
1951. There was still rations going on after the Second World War in Ireland. And food was still rationed. And it is a ration book for sugar and tea.
Yeah, incredible history.
Sugar, tea, butter, bread, flour and wheat meal. And you must register with the shopkeeper in order to draw your rations
of
sugar, tea, buttermilk, bread, wheat meal. So she never used one of them. And there is a serial number, 973.
Well, as I say,
and it's issued by the Department of Industry and Commerce in Dublin.
Okay, as I say, well done and well kept, by the way. By the way, it sounds like your phone is from 1951 as well, James.
It is, Joe. Not far off, Joe. I'm using Nokia 3320.
Good, hold on. Oh, that'll be worth a few, Bob. Hold on to it, James. Dimpin' it, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
What have you got for me?
I don't have something which is terribly old, but it is a bit momentous, and it's a ticket. A boxing ticket that I had for Katie Taylor's gold medal winning fight in the Olympics in London. And I also have the tube tickets from that day. I have my boarding passes for my travel with Aer Lingus, and I have a few other little things that I got on the day, little souvenirs. But of course, the ticket is the most important thing to have been there when she made such history.
Okay. And do you have them in a little scrapbook? Have you got them?
Well, I've everything put away together so that when I'm gone, somebody will at least have them, because it was such an important occasion, you know, and that glass ceiling that she went through.
Brilliant.
Nothing can ever be taken away from
that. Well done. I love the way you collected the tickets. Every provenance to give you the date and everything, the ticket.
Yeah,
the
and my name is on the ticket.
Well done,
as well.
Dimpin' it. Richie, you have again, from we spoke to it earlier on the week, the Cuban Missile Crisis. What have you got, Richie?
Hi, Joe. I feel like I'm a bit of a fraud because I don't actually have anything to give.
Okay.
But what I would suggest is something that should be in the museum is the book that was published by the Civil Defence back in 1965.
Which we all, it's every home in Ireland.
every home in Ireland, exactly. And we were advised to keep it for years because
that's
the
right.
threat didn't go away. And I remember that hanging up in houses around the country in kitchen
because people dresses. people were encouraged to stamp a hole in it and put a bit of twine and hang it in case
that's
of
right.
a in case
actually,
of a nuclear attack.
That's exactly it, and I think it came with a hole in the top corner
okay,
and a treasury tag.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
you just assembled it and hung it up on the kitchen dresser, you know,
yeah.
as everybody had back then. And it was a brilliant book. Like there was 32 pages in it.
It was everything.
It's hard to believe now.
Didn't it tell you to always have the bath full of if you had a bath? Always have the
bath
full of
water.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in the house I grew up in West Waterford, we didn't have a bath.
Okay, radiation sickness, how to stop bleeding, artificial respiration, crush injury, a nuclear explosion, what would it be like?
Exactly.
What to do at the moment of the explosion when we know where but run, I mean, nowhere to run. What to do after? And have you got these in the museum? Have you got any of these in the museum, Darrell? You
no,
have to.
We don't actually believe
okay.
it or not.
Okay, well,
I mean,
let's put out a shout. Has anyone got any of those? But it was called Boss.
Yeah.
Boss Ogus Baha. Life
Boss
and death.
Baha, yeah.
Life and death.
Death, exactly. And there was all these little a picture of the world with all these little specks
yeah.
falling on it, you know, red and green.
No worries,
Dago
no worries. Yeah,
well,
just in case you didn't have any worries.
What we do have, Richie, are unopened iodine tablets. We have a couple of boxes of those.
Well, that's from a later generation.
Later, definitely, yeah. But...
It was a little book that scared the living daylights out of me.
Yeah.
And I used to read it. I was only barely able to read. But I was always amazed that my parents didn't take it more seriously, you know.
Yeah.
My mother used to say, you know, she'd take a puff of her fag and she'd say, Asher, if the bomb goes off, we're all
finished. That's true. The bomb. That phrase, well spotted, Richie. If the bomb goes off. Okay, that's Richie D. I have one more break to take back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Mildred Byrne is in County Roscommon. What have you got in there, Mildred, please?
How are you, Joe?
Good, good.
How are you doing?
Great.
I'll tell you what I have. I suppose... maybe it's not the right time to go talking about these sure. things, but in... we had the famous the woodlands of Loch Linn where they when the Civil War was on and the Black and Tans were here.
Okay.
And the famous song, The Woodlands of Loch Linn, and two lads were shot here in the woodlands and by the Black and Tans. And my late husband, who is now deceased 37, 38 years, had a metal detector and he went down to the area where the lads were shot.
Wow.
And he got bullets that was used
okay.
at the shooting of that.
We've an awful lot of bullets, haven't we, Darrell?
too many bullets.
Well, the main thing is, Mildred, you've held on. It's really important. You've held on to them.
Yeah, I did.
Right.
I did because it's history. It's part of history, you know, and all that sort of thing. And plus, it's down the road from us. Just
yeah,
like
history,
2
local
minutes
history.
Down the road.
Just so brilliant.
It's local
so
history.
Brilliant. So
and
brilliant.
Brendan Shine has recorded the song "The Woodlands of Loch Linn." So,
yeah.
And we had a nun here in the convent beside us, and the lads were going from one safe house to another.
And that was
and,
that's 1921, well over 100 years ago, 105
yeah, the
years
19th
ago.
Of April, the 19th of April 1921.
Well, hold on to them and keep them well catalogued and marked. That's Mildred Guttermarget, Owen Bourke.
God bless you, Joe.
God bless you too, Mildred, and happy St. Patrick's weekend. Owen.
Hello, Joe.
Your father worked in Odlums and what the flour mills?
Yeah, the flour mill in Stalins. It was opened up in 1913 and it's only been demolished this week. For the next few weeks, we'll be demolishing it. So we've salvaged a few bits and pieces from it. We have a flour bag from the 1930s.
Okay.
We have a trolley from that used to carry the bags of flour. We have a weighing scales. The Salins Historical Society got access to the mill. It hasn't been used now for over a decade, but they've seen one of the old scales still inside the mill. So there's going to be a talk in Salins on the 7th
right.
of April in the Railway Inn pub all about the mill.
Okay.
Liam Kenny, the local historian.
Okay, well done, Owen. Vivian, finish. Back to Michael Collins. Well, your great-grandfather made Michael Collins' first uniform.
Yes,
in Northumberland Square in Dublin.
Yes, my great-grandfather,
wow.
he was Nolan,
And there were four generations of my family grew up in Northumberland Square before it was knocked down for Irish Life.
In the centre of Dublin there, yeah, off Abbey, yeah. Abbey Street. And have you got any memorabilia? Have you got any, did Michael Collins sign anything?
Yeah, Michael Collins did sign a history book and gave it to my great-grandfather. And it was the first edition, but unfortunately it disappeared.
Ah.
Never to be found again.
Okay. What a great story, nevertheless. Thank you indeed, Vivian. Vivian McSherry, thanks indeed to Dr. Daryl Hendley Rooney, Little Museum of Dublin, reopening during the summer, we hope. Yeah. And you have a long, long list there from today's fantastic response, Daryl, and you will go through all of them, I know, as you were noting them on sound. Lee Mullen, BCO Shane Galvin, producer Shanna Gorman, series producer Annette Egan. And if you're in and around Carnew tonight, the amateur South Wicklow Drama Festival, the 18th one is on. It's opening at 8 o'clock in St. Bridget's Hall, and I'm doing the honours gladly. It's The Weir by Conor McPherson. Thank you all. Thank you, Daryl. And how do people contact you, Daryl?
Your listeners can contact us at hello@littlemuseum.ie and we'd be delighted to respond.
Or they can post to the Little Museum of Dublin, Stephen's Green.
Yeah,
letter or note. An old
I tell you, don't send it because it's a building site. It's being renovated. Okay. So don't send it to 15 Stephen's Green, but the best way, or a phone call.
Okay, we go over to now. Ray Darcy is in Studio One. Raymond.
Lifeline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in-store and online at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.